Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order today. Welcome, everyone. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2105. Nazem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2105 comes to you from a long path and it went through in the House side, House Revenue Committee. We've had several hearings and a few amendments before it became House Bill 2105A. And in the amendments that occurred in the original bill, first the original bill would have authorization to state agencies and public bodies to purchase and hold bonds issued by that same state agency or the public body, and without causing that bond to go through the automatic cancellation or extinguishment of the debt. It authorizes state agencies and public bodies to use bond proceeds or money available for debt service to purchase bonds of the state agency or the public body when. However, the amendments that happened on the House side, it gave the direction to the state treasurer to report to the legislative authority or the legislative session, if it's in session at that time, within 48 hours of exercising this authority that is basically has to deal with the buying of those bonds. It also requires the state treasurer to give an annual report on this authority that is being exercised and whether it was exercised or not. And you have also in your packet, Madam Chair, your revenue impact statement and fiscal impact statements, which in essence talk about the issues of the interest rate resetting mechanisms and the differences and the risks that would be inherent in short-term versus long-term rates that are fixed versus variable, and that is both on the fiscal and the revenue side. And that's how the bill comes to you.
Okay, and we have no subsequent on this, correct?
No subsequent.
Okie dokie. Let's hear from Carol McCoug. You want to come up, Michael?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I am not Carol McCoug. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio with the Office of the State Treasurer. And if it pleases the committee, I will introduce the bill to you. House Bill 2105 comes from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission and the Office of the Oregon State Treasurer. Last year, when the financial markets crashed unexpectedly, there was a lack of demand for variable rate bonds in the resulting credit crunch, and as a result, interest rates for variable rate debt, some held by state agencies, shot up extremely high, sometimes as high as 8%. As a tool in our financial toolbox, House Bill 2105A would give us the ability to sell those bonds to the issuer without extinguishing the bond issue, which would help lock in a more advantageous interest rate. Hopefully we would never have to use that authority, but it is a good tool to have in the event that it happens 2 years from now, 10 years, or never. As was referenced by staff, the bill now contains reporting requirements for the state treasurer's office every time the ability is used, and also yearly to report on whether or not it was used.
Okay, and this is kind of a refinancing mechanism for bonds?
Exactly. You could call this a refinancing mechanism, absolutely.
Okay. And you said that it would be very rarely used. Would you have used it had you had it this last time around? And what happened to that situation?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, if this process had been in place last year, agencies would have been able to lock in better interest rates and save, I think the number that we came up with was $2 million.
Could I speak?
Yes. Laura Lockwood McCall with our office will give some context to that.
For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall from Director of Debt Management in the Treasurer's Office. We have three bond programs in the state that currently use variable rate debt in their overall debt management portfolio. Two of those are mortgage programs, Oregon Housing Community Services and Veterans Department of Veteran Affairs. And using a portion of their debt in variable rate mode helps lower the overall loan costs to the borrower. So it's not 100% of their overall debt portfolio, but there's a percentage. They also have assets, which they invest in generally taxable securities. So we're not talking about really refinancing. We need to be a little careful. What they're doing is if they can earn a certain rate of return on their assets, but their debt is at a lower cost because it's tax exempt, that's a good thing. Temporarily, because the debt rate went shooting up, it would have been wiser for them to take those cash assets and temporarily purchase their own bonds rather than pay those high rates once the credit markets calmed back down. And, you know, rates shot up once Lehman filed for bankruptcy, and they were high probably through the end of October, and then things started leveling back off. We've calculated, and I should mention the third agency is ODOT. And, again, they have investment balances, and they have some variable rate debt in their portfolio. Overall, it's 12% of all the state's debt. So for ODOT and for vets in particular who have who saw some of the worst of the spikes, we estimated that each agency would have saved $1 million on a net basis. So what they foregone in interest earnings was more than saved by because they wouldn't have had to pay that high interest rate. And we just made an assumption that they would have then unwound those investments in their own bonds and gone back and sold them to investors once the investor base came back to more normal levels and gone back into their original investments, which were short-term treasury securities for the most part.
Okay, and what is the rate now?
Well, I didn't check this week, but the rates have gone down to about 0.5%. So this is a weekly rate. These are weekly floaters. And it really wasn't our credit that caused the problem. The problem was a worldwide credit crunch. And each of our variable rate programs, we have a liquidity provider. Because on a day-to-day basis, any investor, money market funds, they can always put the bonds back every week. Mm-hmm. And it was liquidity providers for ODOT and ODVA, which was Dexia, which was one of the companies that got into a lot of heat, like AIG did as well. And so it was really about their credit, not us. It had nothing to do with us. And this bill doesn't just cover us as a state, but also all local governments, which is Carol can speak to. There's many other issuers in the state who also use variable rate debt in their portfolio management who have experienced really, really severe dislocations between their assets and liabilities.
But the reporting requirement would rest with the treasurer, is that correct? Even if a local government
uses it? Well, through the chair, I wish I could tell you that we could force local governments to report, but the truth is we don't really have a mechanism to enforce that. So we asked at the House side that we would be more than happy to let you know when these situations occur and to do mathematical calculations, but we really don't have a way to get local governments to report, other than voluntarily.
Is there any risk or downside from using this technique? I mean, obviously the House put the reporting requirement in as, you know, so they could monitor it. What would be the downside risk?
My only guess would be a worldwide meltdown where we ended up holding those securities for longer than these relatively short periods of time. And then we might be in a position, let's say ODVA had to buy back its own bonds. Well, at some point, it's cheaper to have owned them than to invest, but we've been earning a positive spread, and that positive spread has been helping fund programs that the general fund doesn't have to fund. So in the short run, I don't see a risk. In the long run, there could be some potential budget implications. Similarly, for ODOT, if they needed to pay payroll, then that would be a problem. But I'm assuming in case of ODOT, there's new revenues coming in. And so this is really their fund balance. So those are the limited risks that I see. I think it's a tool many other states, I was asked by one of the legislators in the House side to try and do a survey of other states. Many of the states that responded to my request for information had this in place already throughout the country. We just don't have any case law, and so I think if you'd like to hear some testimony from Carol, who's the chair of MDAC and a bond counsel, she can explain why we felt we needed to go this extra step in Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Carol, you're the only person who actually signed up, so the least we can do is let you talk.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoug. I'm a partner with the law firm of K&L Gates, and we do serve as bond counsel to a number of state agencies and local governments, and I'm currently serving as chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. And to sort of summarize some of the concepts that have been floating around here in our testimony, this bill, the applicability of this bill does arise primarily in the variable rate. There are two types of variable rate, auction rate, variable rate bond markets. And the structure of those bonds are such that the interest rate is set with a Dutch auction style auctioning of the bonds, where new investors will come and they'll buy the bonds and set the interest rate for a week in most cases. Auction rate bonds are credit enhanced with bond insurance, and variable rate demand bonds are enhanced by letters of credit from banks. So when the financial markets were extremely dislocated in late 2008 and bond insurers were downgraded and investors lost confidence in financial institutions that were issuing these letters of credit, investors didn't want to touch auction rate bonds or variable rate bonds. So the owners of the bonds couldn't sell them back out. What happens in those circumstances on auction rate bonds is the current owners have to hold on to them, but under the documents, the interest rate spikes up to whatever's prescribed in the document, sometimes as high as 8, sometimes 12, sometimes higher. In variable rate demand bonds, the bank will have to purchase the bonds in those situations, but if they cannot resell the bonds, then the principal and interest principal amount will amortize over a short period of time at a very high interest rate. So issuers in these circumstances were, as Laura mentioned, the unfortunate victims of downgrades by insurance companies and financial problems with the letter of credit banks. And so issuers who are finding themselves in the situation of having to pay these extremely high interest rates when they were budgeting for weekly low interest rates thought that, gee, maybe it'd be better if they just bought their own bonds. We think that the state and local governments, you could piece together some authority to do that. But certainly as the lawyers working on the deals, we like to have clarity that these issuers do have the authority to purchase their own bonds. So that's one of the things that we are clarifying in this bill. The other thing is that there is a common law legal theory that if one buys its own bonds, that debt is extinguished. So in these cases where these issuers purchase the insurance, the very insurance that's causing them the problem, or the letter of credit, they bought these things up front. They paid a premium up front to last the life of the bonds. So in these cases, they may want to, when the markets come back and maybe some of the financial institutions are rehabilitated, insurers come back, they can resell out the bonds again to the market that has recovered. So another thing that we're clarifying with this bill is that a purchase of an issuer's own bonds does not extinguish that debt. The bond is still live.
Right. I think that's pretty key. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you see a need, a need to put some sidebars or some protection on those cash balances so that we make sure that there's enough cash left in one of these agencies so that they don't, minimum balances or percentage of these bonds to their cash balance?
Well,
if I may, through the chair, Senator Toeffler, the rating agencies serve a very fine function because they have rules and regs about really how much variable rate debt is appropriate. Typically, it's 20 to 25% unhedged. Veterans Mortgages has a higher percentage, but that's a unique case because they have a really large balance sheet with a very healthy set of assets, and so they've matched their liabilities and their assets well. So we're looking for getting the lowest cost of funds, so perhaps you could add some more, but we, in the treasurer's office, care quite a bit about getting the lowest cost of funds, and that's through getting a good credit rating. So there is a larger system in place. Now, if you're talking about how to make sure the legislature doesn't take the fund balances, I would concur that you would hurt the credit rating if you were to suddenly take all the assets of the veterans program but still leave the variable rate liabilities on their balance sheet. But I do think that the overall credit markets, the rating process, investors' review of our balance, keep that in line.
Madam Chair, follow up.
I'm referring to, because I wasn't talking about cash balances, particularly those that are fungible. What I was talking about is the fiscal analysis where it says the use of cash balances to purchase the securities could, therefore, absorb cash needed for other purposes for considerable periods of time. I was looking at some sort of protection from...
Is this an LRO report?
This is our revenue statement. Are you going from the major summary?
This is the fiscal analysis.
I wasn't privy to the analysis. I can only tell you these three agencies that we're talking about, and there are some representatives, I think, at least from one or two, who could speak to it. In ODOT's case, they have a fairly significant cash balance and new revenues coming in. I don't think we'd ever take out more than we have. We have $165 million in variable rate for ODOT, and I think their cash balances are in the neighborhood of $300 to $400 million. And as I said, in the case of VETS, the amount of variable rate outstanding is exactly equal to their investments, and I don't believe it's used for payroll or anything. It's just really an interest-earning machine. Housing may be slightly different, and I would probably need to turn to the CFO for Oregon Housing to talk about what their plan is and how they manage. It's a little tighter balance.
There was a concern flagged here, and I'm still concerned. So nothing major, but...
But that also raises a question of how the local governments would handle this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that what is important to keep in terms of the perspective is that what this is primarily a temporary solution to a problem with respect to the dislocation of these variable rate markets. And certainly when these events occurred, all issuers were looking and moving forward on trying to find long-term solutions to these problems, essentially trying to look at fixing out some of these variable rate bonds. So it buys us time so that we're not hemorrhaging the cash at these extremely high interest rates that we had only budgeted for very short-term interest rates to, again, buying us some time so we're not hemorrhaging cash while we're coming up with these long-term solutions. I think many issuers who had an opportunity, although they were hemorrhaging cash, have tried to fix out a lot of these bonds. So I think it's something that everybody is looking at as a temporary solution.
If I could add for the chair, in Oregon at least, we track all local government debt. The majority of the local issuers who have issued variable rate debt are either private universities or hospital district authorities, because this is used often by truly enterprise fund who are matching assets and liabilities. You don't have, I don't think, a school district, or I can't think of only perhaps City of Portland sewer program. Really, only very sophisticated issuers would even go into the variable rate market. And as Carol mentioned, a number of the folks who came through Oregon Facilities Authority, who were private universities, went ahead and refunded their debt from variable rate mode into fixed rate mode. So as long as there's a fixed rate market and there's investors in that market, again, you could get your cash back. It's just you're just out of the mode that you were in before. So this is just one more tool to help manage your overall balance sheet.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the sentence from LFO that precedes the sentence quoted by Senator Telfer characterizes the issue, and I might quote that. LFO notes that any state agency or public body exercising the authorities established by this bill would be assuming considerable risk, as it would always be uncertain when the market conditions for securities would improve. So, you know, the characterization, it's a temporary backfill fix to stop unnecessary expense. It may not be temporary, and therefore you've recommitted cash that you might need for other, for the intended purposes for which the bond was issued. And that's a judgment call. I don't know how we can influence that one way or the other, if I'm reading this correctly.
So it's a risk analysis. It would give them, you know, on the one hand, it would cost them this much to not have this authority, and the downside risk would cost them if things didn't break their way.
I wouldn't disagree through the chair, Senator Morse, but we just experienced, I think, the worst event that's occurred in my public sector career of over 25 years, and I thought I've been through a lot. And the markets have come back, the tax-exempt markets. I've sold six series of fixed-rate bonds for the state since February, and my all-in borrowing costs and all of those, the highest was 4.74% for 25 years. So I was pretty scared back in the fall about what was going to happen to the credit markets, and, you know, the whole place would have to go down for there not to be people interested. So I think that's a calculation each board, local government, the state. That's why we've added this language where we're going to let the legislature, LFO, LRO, know if we choose to use that. And it's only in these extreme circumstances where it's, frankly, cheaper to just to get a breathing period than to bleed. And I was told that housing also has some additional information on their balance sheet and what the savings might have been.
Okay. Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
For the record, Nancy Kane, Chief Financial Officer, Oregon Housing Community Services Department. What I'd like to address is the liquidity of the funds. We have a number of reserves and investment vehicles that we use. For instance, we invest very, very short term on the funds that we're using for the acquisition of our loans. Then we have revenue accounts that have a longer duration, more 6 months to a year. And then we have some other reserves, our insurance reserves. We invest out 3 to 5 years, and we have debt service reserves that even have a longer maturity. And why I tell you about those is that should we buy our bonds as a short-term investment and be unable to liquidate those bonds, we would liquidate other investments in those other accounts and take the our bonds into the longer maturity of reserves, so that we wouldn't need those reserves or those that cash immediately. The reserves and the investments that we invest in otherwise are all U.S. agency-backed investments. They're traded regularly and highly rated. So that concern about holding or being held obligated in having these in our investment portfolio and being unable to liquidate them would not be a significant risk. The other issue I'd like to address is just the management of the assets. You pay your state agencies to manage those risks. This is just one risk in the broad spectrum of issuing bonds. We have access to bond counsel. We have access to Treasury, which provides great support to us and financial advice. And we also have financial advisors who help us make the very best decisions. So what you're asking is, what controls would we have? We would never, I don't think we would ever, we wouldn't invest more in these bonds, our own bonds, knowing that we could have to hold them longer term. So we would look at this investment as just one investment in our entire portfolio of investments. And just as we don't put all of our eggs in one security, we would not put all of our available resources into our bonds. It would be just one potential investment that we would limit to the amount of risk that we think we could take with this at that particular time.
Okay, and I gather this kind of risk analysis is the sort of thing that goes on everywhere on other issues before this bill was ever invented.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes,
I understand there's a lot of things with the financial crisis and the problems that became reality that we never thought could ever possibly be within the realms of reality. But the main thing remains is you get risk reward by lowering your interest rate. So if you're willing to take more risk, you get lower rates. Whether it's short-term, long-term, it doesn't matter. What the agencies or a couple of the agencies, states, are doing is assuming a little more risk to take advantage of lower interest rates. Now, that became more acceptable with time in government and financial and public finance as there were more comfort with the risk amounts that is being taken. There is a school within public finance that says, you know, government should not probably be in short-term auction type of resetting bond that happens every week. And I suspect before this whole bout of re-regulation comes in, that will be a significant, considerable restriction on government's ability to do that. That is coming from probably the U.S. Treasury as well as the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. So I think what they're trying to do with this bill is not necessarily change that, but have a very small legal assurance that if we have to do this, it doesn't mean that we extinguish our bond, but it is not touching the issue of whether there is less risk or more risk. They're saying there's still risk exists. However, we're trying to just issue this little piece, make it workable within that risk frame. But the risk still exists.
Senator Telford.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I'm feeling a little bit more confident with the sophistication we have at the state level. But this also applies to more local public bodies. And I'm concerned with the sophistication level they have there, maybe, and would not want to give them a tool in their toolbox that they may be sorry they used now that we have some reality of what the market really can do.
Again, through the chair, Senator Telfer, right now any local government could issue variable rate debt. The real risk is the variable rate and whether that's a good tool or a bad tool. But again, local government, public bodies includes very sophisticated hospital districts that sell bonds on behalf of nonprofit hospitals throughout the state, universities, as well as very small, every little water district. So I think the deeper question that you're asking is should certain districts be allowed to issue variable rate debt? And I think because really that is what opens the store. If you sold everything fixed rate, and there was no ability to sell variable rate, then this wouldn't be an issue. But many jurisdictions, many local governments have fairly significant assets. And so if you sell fixed rate debt that you have floating rate assets, you actually create more risk than if your liabilities and your assets are matched and they float together. You actually reduce risk on a balance sheet. So that is why many universities and hospitals have gone towards variable rate debt.
No, I'm not worried about whether, I mean, there's inherent risk with variable rates. My concern is the liquidity or the potential loss of liquidity because we're using cash balances to buy back these bonds. And I don't see anything in here that protects somebody from using a lot of their cash and then has a liquidity problem because they're stuck. And so I'm not seeing any sidebars or some protections built into this. Obviously, we have a fairly sophisticated state level, but I'm more concerned with the local communities, the small towns, small public bodies that may be doing this and then wanting to buy back and using cash and not being as sophisticated and knowing, what the percentage of that holdings should be to their cash balance. So,
through the chair, Senator Telfer, I would say as part of the local government issuing community that it is, as Ms. Lockwood-McCall stated, only the most sophisticated issuers that dip their toe into the variable rate market to begin with. In our experience in surveying and working with many local government issuers, I can think of only the City of Portland and the Port of Portland that actually have auction rate or variable rate bonds outstanding as direct governmental issuers. And then you do have the next level, which are the hospitals, facilities authorities, and the other conduit authorities that are issuing on behalf of the private universities and the large hospital systems that have sophisticated financial people managing their cash and again, managing the deciding that the variable rate and their asset management is a good tool for them. So if it is comforting to know about the sophistication level of your state folks who are managing this, I can tell you with confidence that the only local government issuers that are involved and would potentially utilize this tool are currently the sophisticated local governments.
You have a requirement in here that if a state agency uses this authority, they have to inform the treasurer's office. Could we put something in there that the same if the local government, is there any, was that discussed in the House?
We could put that requirement, but truthfully, I wouldn't have a way to know with great certainty whether it happened or not. And so it would be a voluntary reporting because be up to the right bond counsel. I don't even know if bond counsel would always know. We could try, but I my concern is only that you would have a perfect report or a perfect universe.
But you don't see a problem here in the universe as it exists today in terms of the local.
Well,
correct. No. Madam Chair, that's right. That's right.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the issue, as you described, was brought up exactly to the House committee and was discussed. And as Laura Lockwood-McCall suggested, we do lack the authority to command them to report to us. Just to reiterate that the discussion has occurred in the House.
Madam Chair, the discussion that happened is slightly different than what you're asking. I think what you're saying is, can we put in the law a requirement that says in 48 hours, if a local government wants to use this, has to notify the state treasurer, which notifies the legislature? That's different than the report that we asked for at the House. And then we changed our mind because of the overburden requirement for the...
Okay.
So that's a different thing that if you want, we could probably look for an amendment of that sort.
No, I'm just not sure it's necessary based on what I'm hearing.
It's a little different.
I believe you wanted us to prepare a report, and that was
right.
What the problem
right.
Is that I wasn't quite sure how.
And the chair is asking
because you wanted to know how much savings were involved, and I was trying to figure out how I'm going to compel someone to calculate it a certain way. As I said, you can put that in the law that you'd like people to report to us, and we'd be happy to report forward.
Well, no, I was just thinking in terms of if there were an unsophisticated group out there that if they had to report to somebody, that it could be an early warning that
sure.
They were headed to some kind of doom.
Something.
We do have a local debt reporting system that I put in a budget request for an upgrade, in fact. can't avoid the plug. Got a dollar, so didn't quite get the full amount. But it again, is only as good as people actually reporting. So we do track local government debt, but it's very much a voluntary compliance system. And so that's part of my concern is that even with the early warning system, it's only as good as if the people report that they have variable rate debt in the first place for us to kind of go out and proactively make sure we knew where the status of their bonds were.
And Madam Chair, just to reiterate, this may not... I'm sorry.
Let's let Senator Morris ask
a
question.
Madam Chair, thank you. With respect to the issue raised by Senator Telfer, the language of the bill requires approval of the state treasurer, and then the definition of related agency in ORS 286A.001 is means the state agency that requests the state treasurer to issue bonds. So it sounds like that even though we're talking about in Section 4 local charters and those bodies, and maybe explain how this works, because the definition of related would exclude
public bodies. Yes, that's why, because we have related agencies of the state, and we're more than happy to report. It's those public bodies, which are the local governments, that we don't know what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. To get that information for a report to the legislature would be difficult at best.
So the risk that Senator Telfer is referencing could occur, and we just wouldn't know about it.
Correct, and that's what they were saying. Okay. They could, yeah. We could ask them to report,
yeah,
but
it just doesn't.
We can't compel them. Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions?
So maybe the question is, why did we include public bodies? Why not just state agencies in the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Telfer, there are a couple of sophisticated local governments who have very bright debt outstanding, as I mentioned, the City of Portland and the Port of Portland. So this bill would benefit them should they need to use this tool. And a number of what we call conduit local government issuers who have issued on behalf of private universities and hospital facilities, hospital systems, that would, on behalf of the those entities, would utilize this as well. So it is something that the local governments do believe is beneficial for them as well.
Is there any way that, I mean, obviously you can't say only sophisticated people can take advantage of this, but is there any criterion you could use in terms of size, or would it be if only the sophisticated ones are using the variable bonds, would it be unnecessary to establish that in here? I mean, is there any way of getting at this issue so that you don't have some small, unsophisticated organization saying, hey, guess what we found? Let's go do this, which I doubt would happen, but I think that's what your concern is. And is there any way you could narrow this down to only the larger public bodies or the ones who are more likely to take advantage of this in the first place?
Madam Chair, I do think that goes back to the point that Ms. Lockwood-McCall was making, in that currently all local governments have the authority to issue variable rate bonds. And so if you're allowing all local governments to issue variable rate bonds, it seems imbalanced to then not provide them with the flexibility, if should they need this tool, to as a cash management tool, in essence, mm-hmm. to utilize that. But I think my examples of only the sophisticated issuers issuing variable rate bonds is a demonstration that most of the local governments really want to stay away from variable rate bonds because they are very risk adverse.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm reassured by that.
I just come from 6 years of being on a city council, and I just... You know, the things local city governments do can amaze you.
Well, and I think probably the solution is, if this gets to be a problem, it's probably another bill to take away the authority to issue variable rate bonds, which we probably don't want to get into at this point in the session. Okay, anything else anybody wants to ask, or anything you all want to add? Committee, I am comfortable with this bill after this discussion. If everyone else feels the same, we can move it on its way. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2105 and open a work session on House Bill 2105. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2105 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved House Bill 2105 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just comment that I appreciate the answers to my concerns. I do feel a lot more comfortable with this. Okay. It's kind of like, you know, if they want to do a foolish thing, I don't want to regulate somebody else's foolishness right now. So,
any other discussion?
We do enough of that of our own.
Exactly. We still want to make the matter worse. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this bill?
Oh, not particularly, but I will.
This is a time in the session where we all just have to
suck it up. I guess I'll be voting no on the rest of them, so I don't...
We have to just suck it up, Senator Telfer. But if you really don't want it, I can reassign it. Okay. Now we will open a work session on House Bill 2107.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2107 came in front of you a couple of weeks ago. And at that time, during the discussion, we had also discussion of a Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2107. Now, the Dash 2 talked about allowing local governments to issue a different level of bonds, different kinds. And at that time, there was a discussion and also a requirement by the Department of Revenue to look into the different implications that comes with the local budget law and how it does. And I think you probably have in, or if you don't have, you will soon, from a memo from John Phillips about that concern that they would they were talking about in the discussion at that time about the local budget law implication and so on.
And committee, you should have I have a copy of that memo in my file, and I think you probably should too, from John Phillips. Okay.
And if you don't, John is here. And
yeah, we'll bring him up if we need him. Okay.
So, and in essence, Madam Chair, it clarifies that they've looked into it, and it doesn't have any of the fears that they thought might be associated with the bill are okay. They're just not being much.
Oh, I have
the
right number. Got it?
Yeah. In Dash 2. We got the Dash
2.
I think this testimony that we're getting, I believe this testimony that we just got handed out from John Phillips, it repeats the points that he made in the email that I have a copy of, and I think you do too. Okay. Let's see. I don't see a sign-up sheet, but we've got our treasurer team who supports this. We've got John Phillips. Who wants to come up and talk on this? You guys have got to start signing in. From now on, nobody who doesn't sign in gets to talk. Carol McCoug is the only one who's who signed in on anything today.
All right. With that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoug, and I am the chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. House Bill 2107, as previously testified, is a substantially a technical amendment bill to provide some cleanups that we need to make in connection with the general public finance bills, general public finance statutes and other statutes that are in other local government chapters that were, in essence, either missed or inadvertently touched in connection with the 2007 Oregon Law Commission omnibus bill that rewrote the public finance statutes. So the primary body of the bill is dealing with a number of small tweaks, if you will, in various parts of the public finance statutes. If you may recall, there were two amendments that were made to House Bill 2107. Again, one of them was an inadvertent deletion of a cross-reference for school districts to utilize in connection with issuing tax credit bonds that have been recently expanded, authority of which has been recently expanded under the federal stimulus bill. And the other amendment is a change to a statute that would allow, again, in connection with the structuring of tax credit bonds to be structured in a way that is more acceptable to the tax market, yet allow for the annual general obligation bond levy to occur as local governments and taxpayers would expect with respect to their property tax levies.
Okay, and I think I'm going to have to close the public hearing on House Bill 2107 since we weren't posted for one and open a work session on House Bill 2107 and start off by apologizing for people who didn't sign in because you don't have to on a work session. The chair was in public hearing mode and that's the way it was. So anyway, continue.
The previous one.
I think
no, this one was public hearing.
Right.
If we could hear from just John Phillips, because we had some initial concerns from you, and then they were resolved in the dash twos.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Yes, and thank you for the opportunity to review the dash twos. We have thoroughly reviewed them, and in terms of their effects on local budget law for municipalities, bonding, ballot measures, and levy certification, we found no inconsistencies or unintended consequences. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to review that.
Okay, thank you. A very complicated thing. It looks like it's been resolved well. We are in work session. Do people have questions as long as we have all the appropriate people here?
Madam Chair.
Mazin.
The only thing I have to just bring it to your attention, there is no revenue impact associated with this. However, the original bill had no fiscal impact, and we had the statement. But the Dash 2 amendment, unfortunately, we have not received a fiscal on that.
Oh, we haven't a fiscal? Okay.
We have a fiscal on the original.
Oh, I
but
see.
But not on the Dash 2. So,
okay. Let's ask any questions or concerns that we have now, and then we'll bring this bill up later. Senator Telford, did you have any questions?
I did. Just a question. Did we ever get the fiscal impact response from counties, Association of County, Oregon Counties? There's note that we were waiting on that. Had no idea what that might be and didn't know if the counties had, in fact, responded.
Senator Telford, that probably would be part also of the fiscal impact statement that we would be getting.
Appreciate that, but on the original one, it wasn't on there, and right. They said that that was a problem. They didn't have it,
yes.
And I'm just wondering if we now have it.
Not on the original, but the Dash 2 probably would bring that.
Probably, okay.
Yes. So we would be looking at. So the way the fiscal does their work is they send inquiries to all possibly affected agencies or local governments.
Mm-hmm.
This one, because it is so close to local government, they send it to the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities. Asking them a question is, what would this bill do to you if mm-hmm. this bill becomes law? And they wait for that response and include the response in the fiscal analysis in order to give you as much of a view as possible. Sometimes those agencies do not answer, and therefore this one is thought to be a lot more involved with the counties. However, they have not answered.
Okay.
So that's what this means.
And again, my question was, have they answered yet?
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, just there is a representative of a county representative on the MDAC who has been involved in putting this bill together and has been supportive and has not expressed any concern with respect to any fiscal impact for the counties.
Okay, but we have a separate process
sure.
for that. We can't
yes.
we can't move without it. So, Mazin, do you expect the fiscal to be ready by tomorrow on the Dash 2?
That is possible, Madam Chair.
Okay, here's what we'll do, committee. We'll put House Bill 2107 over till tomorrow, and we will also put House Bill 2067, which we do not have the fiscal yet, over till tomorrow. Do we have any other orders of business? We do not. We are adjourned.